First of all, welcome to everybody. We have two cases on our 10:30 docket. We will go from one right on to the next one. We do have some visitors in our court with us today, courtesy of Mr. Bryce Perry, and they are part of the Classical Conversations Co-op, and I guess high school is probably what they are preparing. They're in high school and preparing for a mock trial, so they're visiting some of the courthouses. So we're really lucky to have you here, and we welcome you. All right, so we have two cases. The first one is Main Street Schools versus Jason and Lori Bimmerly, cause number 2-12-471-CV. Council has checked in, but if you will please announce who's arguing. All right. Mr. Ragetz, is that properly pronounced?
Ragetz, Your Honor.
Ragetz, okay. Thank you. If you're ready, proceed.
May it please the court. Are parties entitled to rely on freely bargained agreements? And if not, can parties at least rely on a trial court to render a judgment based on the case that was tried? My name is Mike Ragetz, and with co-counsel Dustin Mock, I represent appellants Montessori Country Day School and William J. Vesterman through the Texas Lawyers for Texas Veterans Program. I will refer to appellants collectively as Country Day School and appellees as the Bimmerlys for purposes of these proceedings. Primary issue before this court is whether trial court can unilaterally decide to rescind a valid and unbreached agreement if the court believes that it can fashion a more equitable outcome than the ones that the parties agreed to. Awarding a remedy, in this case rescission, was not legally possible because, as this court has correctly held in Payne v. Highland Homes just in December of last year, rescission is available to a party only if that party prevails on a claim for which rescission is an available remedy. The Bimmerlys prevailed on zero claims in this case. In fact, the only claim that was tried was for breach of contract. And the court, trial court, did not find breach of contract. Therefore, awarding the remedy of rescission without a claim being established that would qualify for that remedy is reversible error. This case is not complicated. There was a contract with a non-refundable deposit that the Bimmerlys wanted refunded after they decided not to send their child to Country Day School for the 2011 and 2012 school term. We've all made non-refundable deposits. We've all probably been disappointed when they were forfeited when the circumstances did not turn out the way that we wanted them to. However, we probably did not all ask a trial court to excuse us from our contractual obligations. The non-refundable deposit in this case was made so Country Day School could determine how many students it would have to educate for the next school year, and the amount of the deposit represented a choice by the Bimmerlys to take advantage of an 8% discount when the tuition deposit was made for the entire full year. The agreement you have before you that I handed to the court reporter is Exhibit 1. It is the contract that governs the terms, conditions, and obligations of the parties in this case. It is the written agreement. It's the same agreement that everyone signs when they enter into Country Day School. It is the master services agreement, if you will, that governs the obligations, the terms and conditions of the students that is signed when they first enter their child into Country Day School, and it applies through, hopefully, their matriculation, the last grade at Montessori, Country Day School being fifth grade.
And Council, may I ask, was there a fact issue as to whether the school or the parents withdrew the child? It seemed like there was some conflicting testimony perhaps in the briefing that indicated maybe it was almost a mutual decision, and if that matters.
It's our position that the contract governs, you know, whether that would matter or not. As far as the decision being made, the decision that was made that consummated this agreement was the check being presented. The child was already enrolled in school. He had been in that school for 2008, 2009, all the way up to the 2011 school year. Once that agreement had been made once a child was accepted, which they were, the agreement rules what happens to the deposit. As far as, we can go through the contract, as far as paragraph 10, if you will, for an example, the school reserves the absolute right to dismiss a student if the family is unable to follow the policies of the school. Now, the evidence in the record states that that did not happen. The student was never expelled. The student was never dismissed. Now, there seems to be a factual issue, as you noted, that perhaps the Bimberleys didn't feel that this was the right place for the child to attend school, maybe in May of 2011, but this was certainly after the agreement was consummated. And what happens after the contract has been entered into and it's valid, and unless there's a breach, the court is to enforce it.
Thank you.
It is undisputed this agreement was valid. It was not the result of mistake or fraud. In fact, it was an agreement, as I mentioned, the Bimberleys found was perfectly acceptable from 2008 to 2009, from 2009 to 2010, from 2010 to 2011. It wasn't until the situation that we just discussed, where the Bimberleys changed their mind once they had already paid the deposit, that this agreement wasn't fair. And then what had been a happy bargain became an unhappy bargain from their position. However, it is important to note that the parties agreed when they entered in this agreement what the fair outcome would be. And we believe that the trial court disrupting this arrangement, the understanding of the parties, was, again, reversible error. I would like to start with the second point of error that the appellants have asserted, because it is a pure question of law for this court, and that's whether the trial court can award a remedy, in this case rescission, when the Bimberleys failed to establish any claim that would allow that remedy to be awarded. And I just cite briefly two cases from this court. First is the First Family, First Limited Partnership decision, April 18, 2013. Rescission is an equitable remedy to set aside an otherwise legal contract for fraud, mistake, or other reasons, and is generally used when monetary damages would be inadequate. We need to plead, prove, establish an inadequate remedy at law, even for rescission to be considered. And then just this last December in Payne v. Highland Homes, rescission is a remedy that is available only if the contracting party has committed some wrong. It is not an independent claim for relief. Rescission is available to a party only if that party prevails on a claim for which rescission is an available remedy, and that simply did not happen in this case. The Supreme Court of Texas cautioned in Williams v. Glass that courts must not apply legal doctrines to allow parties to avoid the results of unhappy bargains, because parties should be able to rely on freely bargained agreements. This was a happy bargain for many years. Rescission of a contract is available only in these limited situations where you establish a claim that allows you to be entitled to a remedy of rescission, but you also must establish an inadequate remedy at law. In this case, nothing in the pleading suggested that, nothing at the trial suggested that, and we can't imagine what that might be based upon the facts of this case. Which leads us to the third point of error, which is whether it was an abuse of discretion for the trial court to rescind this agreement and then award damages based upon an unjust enrichment theory when neither rescission nor unjust enrichment was even mentioned in the case until the trial court handed down its judgment. Breach of contract can be a basis for awarding rescission. There are certain cases, they're not the main cases in which this remedy is awarded. Most of those are fraud and mutual mistake. However, breach of contract can be. However, a quasi-contract claim, such as unjust enrichment, is unavailable when you have a written contract. That has been confirmed by this court in the City of Colony case. And in this case, there was a written agreement. So there was no notice by Country Day School that this was even in the case. We had a written contract. Why would we be arguing unjust enrichment? It is unavailable under Texas law. So we had to try a case having no idea that rescission was even at play, or certainly unjust enrichment. And what is important to note in this case is, had this been a jury trial, the jury wouldn't have independently decided to rescind the contract and award damages using an unjust enrichment theory that no one knew about. Country Day School was deprived of the fundamental opportunity to defend itself from an equitable claim that no one knew it existed. And finally, to mention the first point of error, Country Day School moved for judgment at the end of the plaintiff's case. At that point, in ruling on a motion for judgment at the close of the plaintiff's case, the trial court is presumed to have ruled on the legal sufficiency and the weight of the evidence. Country Day School didn't put on a case. At the end of the case, there was no evidence of breach of contract. The reason we know this is the trial court found that there was no breach of contract. Therefore, that motion for judgment should have been granted, and at this point, we shouldn't have even had to move past that point. And I would just mention in closing, unless the court has any questions, that this case of great importance, Country Day School, this is the contract that has been used at least since 2008 when the Bimberly signed this agreement, entered in this agreement. This is how they base the school year, hire teachers. This is how they buy furniture, buy supplies. The fundamental operation of the school depends on the validity of this contract, which has never been contested up to this point, and certainly the validity of it has not been put under a shadow to this point in prior situations. We would close that the case has been tried, evidence has been presented, arguments have been made. The error was the judgment. Everything up until that point, this is the case that was tried. And at some juncture, you know, the parties had their day in court. And we ask that this court renders a take-nothing judgment in favor of Country Day School and award Country Day School trial and appellate costs. So if there's no questions, I will sit down.
I have a follow-up question, please. I mean, I know what you're saying is that they should have recovered nothing based on your contract or agreement. But wasn't there some discussion in the briefing as to how the trial court came up with half of the contract price? Do you disagree with that as well?
Well, we just...
Separately and apart from...
Separately and apart, whether it was... obviously, we don't agree that we were talking about equity. We think there was plenty of evidence in the case, and I can read from the court's record with respect to, I'd probably like to do that if I could, and it appears, and this is on page 43 of the court's record, and it appears that one of your goals is to get a full year payment. Why would you want a full year payment? Well, we do all different types of things for the parents. Whatever tuition deposit we take is important, because if we didn't take tuition deposits, parents could decide for whatever reason to withdraw their children. If we had several parents do that after we invested into teachers' contracts, which we usually sign in April, materials for the classroom, furniture for the school, and all the other things that we invest in the school, if we had a lot of parents decide all of a sudden to pull their children out because there was no deposit to bind them, we wouldn't be able to run our business properly. We wouldn't be able to educate the children properly. We have very high standards. We have been there for 25 years. Question, you mentioned teachers. Do these teachers have contracts for the year? Yes, yes. Which we sign in April. When do they sign them? In April. These are preparations that are made. The trial court determined, once it had been unshackled as it was from the contractual agreement, decided that it was inequity at that point, and decided that those reasons weren't important enough to enforce the agreement. And I think if you will read, the court basically said that in Reporters Record 58, that enforcing this contract to allow the full tuition to be retained by the defendant would have been inequitable. He said that on the record. That's what this case is. I do not want to enforce this contract. No wrong has been committed, no breach, no fraud. I just don't want to enforce this agreement because I believe it would be inequitable. So we don't believe that it should have ever gotten to that point. But if they were, the trial court made a determination that he thought, based upon his understanding of the facts, that the court didn't really need the amount of the tuition deposit that was agreed to by the parties originally. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Now we have Mr. Hassett. If you'll give us just a moment, we have to change a tape. Or you ready? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Welcome back, Justice Walker, for our second oral argument in this case. I'm going to try not to say the exact same thing that I said in the first oral argument, because I know that you don't want to hear the same things over again. I hear Mr. Regetz tell the court that this trial court should not have exercised equity and fashioned a remedy in equity in this case. But we have a fundamental difference of opinion in that regard, in that at its heart, I believe this case is an equitable proceeding, and that the trial court had the discretion necessary to fashion a remedy, and that remedy was right, because it would simply have been unfair to allow the Country Day School to retain an entire year's worth of tuition without having to provide a single day's worth of service for that payment. I'm pleased to be here representing the Bimmerleys. This case has been going on for an awfully long time for an awful small amount of money, but at its heart, we do believe this is an equitable proceeding. Mr. Regetz has made some arguments before you today that I think have been waived, and I set those out in my brief because no special exceptions were ever written and filed in this case. And so any complaints about what was in the pleading and what was lacking from the pleading or what should have been there that they didn't have notice of should have been cleared up by a written special exception. And the case law is very clear that if you don't make that kind of special exception, those points are waived, and I think that applies to the second and third points of error that Mr. Regetz has briefed for the court. Whether to grant rescission in this case is certainly within the sound discretion of this trial court. He was the second trial court. The Justice Court was the first trial court. But what Mr. Regetz has told the court, that setting aside a valid legal contract under a theory of rescission can happen when there's fraud, when there's mistake. And what he glossed over was that the rest of that statement of law, which is in my brief, which is, quote, for some other reason, the court must set it aside to avoid unjust enrichment. It's consistent with the nature of rescission. That's the statement that's made in the City of Colony case that's cited by the appellants. It's the statement of law that's cited by Fain, which is cited by the appellants. So what must be set aside to avoid unjust enrichment? What does that mean? In this case, and that's what all of the rescission cases talk about, is the specific facts that are before the court. In this case, you've got a full year's worth of tuition being given in April of 2011 for the 2011, it was given in April of 2011 for the 2011-2012 school year, which would begin in August of 2011. You're not required to do that. There's evidence in the testimony at the trial court. Mr. Vesterman himself testified that they allow students and their parents to pay tuition in a number of different ways. One, in an advance payment up front in April, is when they usually ask for that, or monthly payments. And what Mr. Vesterman testified to was, if a student comes in and is paying his tuition monthly, let's say he comes in August, he pays August, and he pays September, and his parents say, we need to withdraw, this isn't working, for whatever reason. Mr. Vesterman testified he would not then go to those parents and say, well, we've already enrolled you, we've planned for teachers, we've paid those teachers, we've signed those contracts, so I need you to continue to pay your tuition October, November, December, et cetera, through the end of the school year. He would not do that. He does not do that. It is not their practice. That is in the record. So what makes it different when a parent comes in and says, here's my $6,296 for tuition for next school year? There is simply no rational basis to say that those parents should be punished if they, in effect, choose not to enroll. And we've had this discussion in the first argument, and I know there was some comment by Mr. Regetz in the motion to request the second argument about enrollment. I take the position that Mr. and Mrs. Bimmerly's son was not enrolled for the 2011-2012 school year, because in May of 2011, shortly after they paid the tuition, they had an exit interview, and in that exit interview they were disturbed by the conversation that they had with Mr. and Mrs. Vesterman, and they chose not to enroll their child for the following school year. I believe enrollment means actually attending classes. I think that's the common use of the language of enroll. And in fact, if you look at the plaintiff's exhibit 3 in the clerk's record, that's a memorandum with the invoice requesting the full tuition payment from the Bimmerleys. And Mrs. Vesterman wrote that memorandum, and she wrote that it would be best to receive his registration as soon as possible. I think there's a difference between registering a kid for next year and actually attending classes, which would what I would consider to be enrollment. But in any event, in May of 2011, the Bemerleys decided not to go forward with enrollment of their son in the school. And I think what's interesting in this case particularly is the reaction that they received from the Vestermans in the school to that statement, I'm not going to go forward. It was, okay, I'll get you your money back. Okay, I'll refund your tuition. I can't do it right now, but I can start making you payments next month. And those are replete in the record as promise after promise after promise to return the tuition. It wasn't a, hey, you signed this 2008 child care law terms and conditions letter, and therefore we don't have to return any of your money. That never came up until we filed this lawsuit. No one ever responded, and what you see in the record is, we promise we'll make you those tuition reimbursement. And the trial court found that there were two separate agreements at issue here. There was the 2008 terms and condition document that's signed by my client, and then there was a second contract for the education of the child in 2011-2012. The obvious terms of that second agreement would be, I pay you for educating my child, and you educate my child. And in this case, they never educated the child. He was withdrawn based on the dispute. Justice Livingston, you asked the question, who made that decision? Well, in that exit interview, the testimony is, in that exit interview, Mr. Vesterman told the Bemerleys that he had concerns about whether or not the child could control his emotions and whether he would be able to stay in the classroom or whether he would have to be pulled out of the classroom. That caused my clients some concern, and they made the decision not to go forward with enrollment for the following year based on a concern that was expressed to them in that manner.
I've got a question. I know that the law allows rescission to avoid unjust enrichment, and you've talked about that, but the second prong of that is when the claimant has been injured by fraud, mistake, or other reason. And I've looked at cases, and I can find fraud, and I can find cases on mistake. I actually found a couple of cases on breach of fiduciary duty, failure of consideration. But it has to be a reason of wrongdoing, it appears, in those cases. So you think this case falls under the other reason. Articulate for me what that other reason is. What is the wrongdoing that gives rise to the entitlement to rescission?
I think the full case law quote from the sites of the cases that I've given you in the brief is, or for other reason, for some other reason.
To avoid unjust enrichment.
The court must set it aside to avoid unjust enrichment. In this case, it would just, the other reason here is the difference in treatment between parents that are paying on a monthly basis and parents that have opted to give a lump sum check up front for the tuition.
So disparate treatment is the wrongdoing that you think gives rise to the remedy of rescission.
In this case, I believe the disparate treatment is evidence of the unjust enrichment if they were allowed to keep it.
But what is the wrongdoing?
Your Honor, I don't know what cases that have pointed that out, a wrongdoing. I believe the case law that I have cited just says to prevent unjust enrichment.
Do you have any cases that allow this in absence of wrongdoing?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I do. I mean, I know the cases that I have cited talk about the prevention of unjust enrichment, and they don't couch that in such a way as there has to be some kind of wrongdoing.
Well, they may not call it wrongdoing, but if it's not, if fraud is wrongdoing.
Absolutely.
And a mistake isn't truly wrongdoing, but it is another reason. And so I'm trying to figure out what that other reason is. It's not other reason to avoid unjust enrichment, and it's the unjust enrichment. It's other reason to avoid unjust enrichment. So I'm trying to figure out what the other reason is. And you're saying it's disparate treatment.
It is. That is my opinion, yes.
Okay.
And I think that just comes back down to a case-by-case situation, and you have to look at the facts. And what was this court looking at? And the court made findings of fact and made a finding that it would be unjust in this case to allow the school to withhold the entirety of the tuition payment. And so what he did was he fashioned a remedy. He took and looked at and heard the testimony of Mr. Vesterman that Mr. Regis just read for the court. They pay teachers. They sign contracts. They prepare for next year based on those numbers. And he made a finding, and he said, there is a rational business decision for withholding a portion of that tuition. However, there's no rational basis for withholding the entirety of it. And he figured in the 8% discount that is given to parents who pay tuition in a lump sum up front. And he came up with $3,129, I believe, is the final judgment in this case. And I think that was correct. I think that he made the right decision. Now, we did not file a cross appeal. We did not file any cross points. We did not ask the court that we did not claim that that's a wrong decision by the court. Frankly, it's time for this case to be done. So we don't want a remand for a new trial on damages. We're here asking the court to affirm the decision of the trial court and nothing more. And that's our prayer, and we ask that of the court. If the court is not inclined to affirm based on the trial court's sound discretion in this case, then I would ask that the court take into consideration the equities of the situation and not tax the costs of this appeal against the Bimmerleys, as they've certainly been through enough in this case. So unless the court has any other questions, I will yield the rest of my time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hassett. Mr. Regis.
First off, with respect to waiver, it is our contention that the pleadings were very deficient with respect to the original petition, but we are not arguing necessarily that the special exceptions hearing shouldn't have been had or shouldn't have been held, but we would say that it was held during trial at Reporter's Record 19 through 22. We asked the court what claims are being tried here, and the answer was breach of contract. And at that point forward, there was no question that the only claim being tried was breach of contract. With respect to, certainly it seems like we're trying to retry the case, at least the facts that have been presented by Mr. Hassett, but with respect to, well, not a single day of service has been provided, this is unfair. I believe this goes back to the City of Colony case. The City of Colony had a contract to process its wastewater treatment, and they said, well, for 5 years we never sent you any wastewater. This is unfair, we need our money back. And Court of Appeals said, no, the contract is the contract. There's a written agreement. You agreed to it. It doesn't matter that they didn't process any wastewater. These are the terms of the agreement, and you cannot claim unjust enrichment as a basis for that. Certainly, Justice Sutter, we did the same research of the same law. We saw fraud. We saw mutual mistake. Those were the main ways. At some point, there may have been breach of contract, but there needs to be a wrongdoing, and this court has confirmed that on several occasions. With respect to whether the child was enrolled, we don't believe it's necessarily important. The contract doesn't rise or fall on enrollment. It's simple. The tuition deposit is refundable only when the child is not accepted. With respect to enrollment, if I went over to the Texas A&M School of Law and I just finished up my first year and registered for classes, I would be enrolled for next semester. I don't have to actually attend that day. I would say that with respect to, if you just want to look at the four corners of the agreement, if you look at paragraph 9, it says when application is accepted, enrollment is for the full term. So that would seem to mean that these things came into existence. They were coextensive at the same time, if that is something that the court is interested in. I don't believe it affects this case. At some point, nothing about enrollment was discussed at trial. It certainly wasn't anything that was used in any finite term during the case or even at the conclusions of law and the findings of fact. It's kind of used loosely throughout the trial. This argument that maybe enrollment has some effect on whether the deposit is refundable is something that's come up since appeal. I believe the appellees dropped it in a footnote number 2 the first time the briefing was filed. Now, with respect to the wrongdoing, I mean, that's the case here as far as our position is. Mr. Hassett said they were being punished because they paid the full year tuition. They were not being punished. They got an 8% discount. They made an affirmative choice. They could have paid month by month. The contract is what the parties agreed to. They could have gone for a semester, and they were able to get a 6% discount. This was a choice they made, just like the choice that they made to not send their child to school. But this was the agreement that the parties had agreed to in advance, and we think disturbing it at this phase, and certainly by the trial court, was reversible error. And with that, I would give up the rest of my time unless the court has any further questions.
All right, Mr. Ruggets, thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Hassett, thank you, and other counsel as well. We appreciate all your briefing and your submission today. We appreciate your patience with the court and taking the time to re-argue as well. Your case is now submitted, and we will recess you all, but the court will stay here to go on with our third case, which is FLCT Limited and Field Street Development versus Frisco.